Welcome to Context, a podcast about the history behind current events in the Middle East. I'm Becky Nyman. The history will be provided through classroom recordings of my late father, historian Dr. David Nyman. This week's episode, It's All Greek to Me, the Complicated Story of Hanukkah. It's no surprise that winter holidays around the world have light as their central theme. So too is the case with Hanukkah, where we celebrate the miracle of the olive oil that fueled the menorah at the rededication of the Temple of Jerusalem by the Maccabees in 164 BCE. But as you might expect, the story of Hanukkah is a lot more complicated than one might imagine. Getting to that olive oil is a journey through the dissolution of Alexander the Great's empire and the first clash between Greece and Rome. The events in ancient Israel are just a small part of an extended regional war. In the first chapter of the complicated Hanukkah story, as told by Dr. David Nyman, Alexander the Great's empire has split in two, and Israel is under the control of the Ptolemaic Empire, centered in Egypt. Greek culture has spread throughout the region, and things are still okay for the Jews under the Ptolemies, where they were free to practice their religion without restriction.
As the result of the death of Alexander the Great, his generals took over with their armies the various parts of the empire, and one empire called the Antigonid, Antigonus was one of his generals, that empire, actually that kingdom, embodied Greece and the adjoining areas, so it was the European part of his empire, which doesn't concern us because the Jews were not involved in that. The two empires that had a great effect on the Jews at the time were the Ptolemaic Empire, and that incorporated Egypt and Israel, and the Seleucid Empire, which was Western Asia. And essentially, the Seleucid Empire was Syria, Iraq, which was Babylonia, of course, and Iran, and some areas adjacent to it. Now, the Jews were now divided between two political entities. The Jews of Babylonia, which was the large Jewish community in Western Asia, were in the Seleucid Empire. The Jews of Israel were in the Ptolemaic Empire. And the Ptolemaic Empire began to develop and built the city of Alexandria, Egypt, as its capital. And the emperors, Ptolemy I and his son and successor, Ptolemy II, they dedicated themselves to making Alexandria the greatest Greek city in the world. And by the way, they succeeded. Alexandria, Egypt became a vast metropolis of Greek civilization and developed in many areas, artistic, scientific, and in many other areas that you can imagine. It became the great center of Greek civilization. What happened in Alexandria is interesting, and it gives us an indication of the transformations that took place in Jewish life as a result of the Alexandrian conquests and the establishment of these empires. Alexandria grew phenomenally from the time of its foundation. The story is Alexander came there, looked at this fishing village on the western branch of the Nile, and told his architects to plan a city there that became Alexandria. Now, 75 years later, the city had become one of the largest cities in the world. We don't know the exact figures, but it had hundreds of thousands population, perhaps close to 1 million, around the year 250 BC, when it was the great metropolis of the Greek world. The other interesting phenomenon is that in that population of Alexandria, a very large proportion were Jews. There may have been 25% of the population were Jewish. The other thing is that in 250 BC, most of the Jews of Alexandria were Greek-speaking, and very few of them were Hebrew-speaking. So there was a very large and rapid acculturation of the Jews. And this happened in other Greek cities, probably in Antioch, in Syria as well. But it's very clear that the Jews of Alexandria in 250 BC were Greek-speaking, they were acculturated. One thing we have to understand also is that the Jewish population of Alexandria had its own, what they called a national assembly. And the Greeks had their own national assembly. And later on, during the reign of the Emperor Claudius of Rome, in his letter to Alexandria, he makes it very clear that Alexandria is a Greek city and that the Jews of Alexandria have full rights to live in Alexandria, but it's clear that they're not citizens of the city. So there is a difference in their national identification. As he mentions in his letter, he says, the Jews of Alexandria have rights in the city which has been accorded to them by emperors in the past, and these rights are not to be curtailed. So he says, the Jews of Alexandria have their rights, they should live there. The Greeks are the citizens of the city, and then he warns them not to start any trouble, because there had been trouble, which is what called for his restriction on the city. Now, between Alexandria and Jerusalem, a very close relationship had developed. You see, Israel was a part of the empire. In Israel, there was a flourishing Jewish population, which had increased, by the way, because the two great capitals were now situated at opposite ends of the country. Since Seleucus had decided to make his capital in northern Syria and Alexandria in Egypt, and Israel is between them, and all the lines of communication and the lines of commercial activity were just flowing from northern Syria through Israel to Egypt and back, Israel became rather prosperous and its population increased. And Jews, by the way, when I ask the question, how did it happen that Alexandria in Egypt from the year 328, let's say, until the year 250, not a long period of time, from zero had become such a great city, and from zero Jewish population suddenly had several hundred thousand Jews? There must have been a migration. And the large Jewish population was Babylonia. And evidently, when we just look at the historical picture, Seleucus had established his capital on the Mediterranean coast of his empire. He had moved or drawn the commercial and cultural center from Babylon to the west. So the boom towns were the great Greek cities on the shores of the Mediterranean. And since these were the cities that were growing, population followed. And I imagine that there was a significant Jewish migration from Babylonia into Antioch and then through the land of Israel to Alexandria, Egypt. Now, since Israel was a part of the Ptolemaic Empire, relations between the Ptolemies and the Jews of Israel were cordial. The figurehead, that is the person who was most prominent in the land of Israel, was the high priest in Jerusalem. I don't know if I mentioned it earlier, but when the Persian Empire had conquered and had absorbed the entire Babylonian Empire, including the land of Israel, and the emperor of Persia, Cyrus the Great, said he wants the temple to be rebuilt and he wants Jerusalem to be rebuilt, he made it very clear that he wanted Jerusalem to be the religious center of the Jewish people, but he didn't want the king of the Jews to live in Jerusalem. You can understand that. So he actually had the king of the Jews living in his palace in Babylonia, where he could keep an eye on him. But Israel was to be the land of the Jewish people, and the major institution would be the temple, and that's the way it remained for several centuries. So the high priest of Jerusalem was the leading figure in the land of Israel, and there were cordial relations between him and his emperor, who was Ptolemy in Alexandria.
Coming up next, the rival Greek empire, the Seleucids, have ambitions. They want to reconstitute the empire of Alexander under their control. They try and fail to conquer Egypt, but later on they succeed in taking over Israel. It is at this point that things take a turn for the worse.
Now, what are the troubles that arise? Because you realize that you can't go through a period of history which is all peace and prosperity. All of a sudden, something happens. And things happened. Both empires, now we're talking about the Empire of Egypt and the Empire of Seleucus over Western Asia, both of them flourished. The economies were booming from 300 BC up to about 220 BC, or from 320 to 220. For a period of 100 years, there was a growing, booming economy and prosperity in both places. And then a decline set in. Stock market began to fall. And the emperor of the Seleucid Empire, and by his name, the name his successor was Antiochus, or Antiochus. And we're talking about Antiochus III. And the time is 220 BC. How does one solve the problems of his empire? Ptolemy also had problems. One of the problems is this. The empires were established around 320 BC after the death of Alexander, and the Greeks were in control. And remember, Ptolemy was a Greek, a Macedonian, who ruled over Egypt. As far as the Egyptians were concerned, he was a foreigner. Now, the initial shock, when the Greeks came in under Alexander the Great and they conquered, they simply submitted to the Greek rule. But after the passage of time, and they caught their breath, and 75 years had passed, and two generations had gone by, the Egyptians began to say, "You Greeks conquered us. Oh yeah, we know that. But our civilization is far older than Greek civilization. We go back 3,000 years, and we're superior to the Greeks. No reason why we should be subservient to the Greeks." That was the mood. A nationalism had arisen. A similar event was happening in the Empire of Antiochus in Western Asia. But the situations are different. Whom did Ptolemy rule? He ruled over Egypt. One nation, that was the nation over which he ruled. What about Seleucus and his successors? They ruled over a polyglot empire. Ptolemy the Fourth, you see, when we go from Ptolemy the First and the Second, and Ptolemy the First and the Second, they were Greek civilization, that was straight ahead, building that. Ptolemy the Third is beginning to see that there is something not quite stable about his position. Ptolemy the Fourth suddenly comes to a realization. He says, "I cannot continue to rule these people as a Greek foreigner. I've got to join them." And so he decided to become Egyptian somehow. And he tried to do it according to their demands and their traditions. And a very interesting thing happened. Ptolemy the Fourth and all the subsequent Ptolemies became, in effect, Egyptians, and they became Egyptian pharaohs. They adopted Egyptian tradition. They probably learned the language. They probably would sail up the Nile in the clothing of the ancient pharaohs. And the Egyptians suddenly realized, well, we don't have to rebel against anything. We are being ruled by our own pharaoh. Antiochus couldn't do that. First of all, he did not establish his capital, or his grandfather didn't establish his capital in Babylon, as Alexander suggested. He established a Greek city on the coast. He was now Greek and identified as a Greek. But what's he going to do if he has 20 different nations in his empire? With whom can he identify? It was not an easy thing. So he reached another conclusion, and that was, I have to reestablish the empire of Alexander the Great. Meaning what? I'm going to conquer Egypt, I'm going to reconstitute the whole thing, and I'm going to continue the process of Hellenization, meaning everybody in this empire is going to learn Greek and will establish a great Greek civilization over the whole empire. It's a nice idea. It's just impossible. Now, Antiochus III then had plans, and they were, he's going to conquer Egypt. When Antiochus III attempted to invade Egypt, Ptolemy IV began to sail up and down the Nile as a pharaoh, speaking to the Egyptians and telling them, we have to rally to defend our homes, our families. We have to defend the land of Egypt against that foreigner who's coming to conquer us. And he rallies the Egyptians against a more superior army. But at the Battle of Raphia, Ptolemy defeats Antiochus III. Antiochus III is stopped, so his plans were spoiled at that point. However, he didn't give up, and then he revised his plans. And they were this land of Israel, which is on the border of Syria. Israel is in Asia. Egypt is in Africa. So he said, well, this land of Israel is mine. Belongs to me. And so he launched another invasion. And here, I guess you could say, the motivation and the psychological thrust was different. When the Egyptians had to fight to retain the land of Israel, which to them was a foreign country, but was a part of their empire, evidently their spirit was not strong enough. And they did move their armies up to the northern part of Israel, but Antiochus was in his own country and he smashed them. And in 199, at the Battle of the Banias, Antiochus III defeated the Egyptians and drove them out of Israel and occupied, that is, he annexed Israel. Now the troubles begin. Just imagine, until 200 BC or 199, the people of Israel are a part of the empire of Ptolemy of Egypt. There is a close relationship. The Jews of Jerusalem and the Jews of Alexandria were one family. And the king of Egypt had a protege who was a friend, the high priest of Jerusalem. That was the relationship between Israel and Egypt for 100 years, 120 years. Now things have changed. Antiochus is now the emperor over Israel. He doesn't want to bother the Jews too much, but these people who are running the country, the officials, the administrators, the bureaucrats, whatever it is, they're all friends of that Egyptian, of that pharaoh, or Ptolemy IV. I can't trust them. The high priest, well, he was a friend of the king of Egypt. How could I trust him? In other words, the whole structure of who rules the land of Israel, these people were now in a very unstable situation. And Antiochus wanted to replace them. And he had plenty of Jews in Syria and in Babylonia who were his subjects, and he wanted to replace the Jews in Israel who had been the subjects of Ptolemy. And so very significant changes began to take place. In fact, Onias III was high priest in Jerusalem, and he felt threatened, and he knew that he was going to be thrown out, and he still felt loyal to Ptolemy. He left Israel with an army, or a following of something like 9,000 people, 9,000 men. And he left Israel and went to Egypt. Now what's interesting is, when he came there, I suppose Ptolemy said to him, why are you here? You were kicked out, weren't you? And he replaced you with another priest. Do you recognize the legitimacy of that priest who's in Jerusalem? And then I said, well, of course not. And he said, well, who is the real priest of the Jewish people? And I says, I am. He said, therefore, you are the priest of the high priest of the whole Jewish nation. And if you can't get back to Jerusalem, you'll build your temple here. So Onias III, with the backing of Ptolemy, actually built a temple of the Jewish people in Egypt, in a place called Leontopolis, which was not too far from Alexandria. So there you have a temple of the Jews in Egypt with a high priest, a legitimate high priest, a temple of the Jews in Jerusalem with another high priest. And this shows you how the problems were being magnified and increased for the Jewish people. A lot of them were in a quandary as to where is our loyalty.
The Jewish community is fractured, with loyalties split between temples. Antiochus III is succeeded by Antiochus IV, who escalates the problem by starting an aggressive campaign of enforced Hellenization.
Antiochus IV has a different approach to the problems of the empire, not subtle. He was more aggressive. And so Antiochus IV built an even greater armed force. And then he started a process of Hellenization, which he wanted to proceed rapidly, and the application of a certain degree of force. Now, the Hellenization process goes through several different stages and different formats. First of all, a Greek city was a very formal organization. As we know from antiquity and ancient history, Greek and Roman cities and the Babylonian cities, they were planned. And in the city, there were many institutions. There was a thing which they called the Acropolis. That's where the main temple of the gods were. Then there were other temples to other gods. The patron god or the patron goddess, for example, Athens, the patron goddess of Athens was Athena, the goddess of wisdom. Her temple was the Parthenon on the Acropolis. So there were many institutions, but these institutions were planned, and the people participated in the religious ceremonies in a certain fashion, a certain pattern. For example, the games, the Olympic games, the athletic games are very important to Greek cities. But the athletic games were not just athletic games. They were preceded by religious ceremonies, by the lighting of fires to the gods, by invocations. I mean, there was ceremony attached to every event in the Greek city. Even that institution, which became the most famous in Alexandria, the Museum of Alexandria, it started out as a little temple to the muses, the goddesses of the fine arts. Museion is what it meant, the temple of the muses. But in this temple of the muses in Alexandria, since the king encouraged it, people came and they used to bring their offerings there. And if they were artists, they would deposit their works of art and their sculptures. It was a cultural center of all the arts of Alexandria, and later on the center of scientists and so on. That's why it grew. And of course, the Museion, which was a temple to the muses, became what we call the museum, namely the repository of art and architecture and literature and so on. And then, of course, it became a center of the great scientists of the Hellenistic period. Now, in Greek culture and civilization, you participated in all of the cultural events, but also in the religious events. Now, under Antiochus IV, he insisted that all of the activities of the peoples in the empire should conform to the Greek form, and that included religious worship. Now, if you read and understand Phoenician civilization and Phoenician religion, you'll notice that Phoenician religion and Greek religion are identical. The difference between them is that Phoenicians speak their language, Greeks speak their language, but religiously, theologically, philosophically, there's no difference between them. Phoenicians could become conforming to Greek religion. All it meant was accepting the fact and acknowledging the fact that Zeus is the equivalent of Baal. Baal is the Phoenician name of the god of thunder and lightning. Zeus is the Greek. Every one of the phenomena could be equated. The same applies to Babylonian, to most of the pagan civilization and religion. Because you know, if you know the names of the Greek gods and the names of the Roman gods, they're the same, except for the language. Zeus is Jupiter, Hera is Juno, and so on. There's no difference between them in terms of their function and their effect on humanity. Where did the problem arise? When you come to the Jews. The Jews couldn't conform. They couldn't accept it. It's one thing that they could not do. As Antiochus and his agents began to enforce this and compel the Jews, then you have a split within the Jewish community itself. There was a group of Jews, and I suppose their ideology went according to the following lines. The Greeks are the wave of the future. They are the advanced civilization. How could we resist this? I mean, the Greeks are the most modern people in the world. We know that. You read their philosophy and their science. This is the ultimate. Why should we resist it? Why can't we conform? Why can't we compromise? And this went so far that priests in the temple in Jerusalem decided that they could compromise with Greek religion and go along with it, even to the extent of us setting up what never existed in the temple in Jerusalem, and that is a statue. A statue to the god Zeus. Of course, the sculpture was made so that the face was the face of Antiochus IV, but that's not important, it's just incidental. The point is, there was a compromise a syncretism that is joining the religions together and creating what many Jews felt was a paganization of Judaism. That is what started a rebellion among the Jews. When they realized, and what they said was the contamination of the temple in Jerusalem, a rebellion broke out. And this we call the Maccabean Rebellion. It's about 170 BC. You see, you have Israel is conquered in 199. We have the reign of Antiochus III. He is not as brutal or insistent as Antiochus IV. But then we have Antiochus IV coming to the throne, and then the troubles begin.
Antiochus IV will not give up on his dream of conquering the Ptolemaic Empire of Egypt. After another attempt, he is unexpectedly thwarted by a small group of soldiers who represent a growing power in the region, the Romans.
Now, Antiochus IV, he started this, and he had Jews who were cooperating, going along with him, and others were beginning to rebel and to resist, and the resistance led to a lot of pain and suffering. Then Antiochus IV felt that he was all ready, and he was going to invade Egypt and conquer Egypt. That campaign had a very interesting result. It's about 170, 169. Antiochus IV marches to the conquest of Egypt, and nobody resists him. He marches through Israel, crosses the Sinai Desert. The Egyptians cannot stop him, and he's on his way to Alexandria. He's on his way to Alexandria when suddenly a small group of men are standing in the road, and they tell him to stop. The man standing there says to him, "I represent the Roman Senate, and our message to you is that you don't conquer Egypt, but turn around and go back." And Antiochus says to him, "And who's going to stop me?" He said, "A Roman army, which is behind me, and they're now approaching." And this confrontation goes on for a short time, and then this Roman has the gall to say, "I'm drawing this circle around you, and you're going to make a decision before you step out of the circle to go back." Antiochus thinks and considers and is wondering what's going to happen. And he turns around and says to his army, "Okay, back home." This Roman with chutzpah, total gall, did it all on his own. He knew that eventually the Romans would come in and drive him back. But in the meantime, he actually bluffed him into retreating. In the meantime, this Roman had sent letters to Rome saying, "This guy wants to conquer Egypt. We better stop him." But at the time it happened, he was all on his own, he and a couple of other men of the embassy. Now, on his way back, Antiochus is going through Israel. So he goes into Jerusalem, and he plunders the temple. I mean, even the fact that they already had idols, and they simply emptied the treasury. And he was frustrated and angry and returned home. And in the meantime, the Jewish rebellion begins to increase. Now we have the Maccabean Rebellion breaking out. And the Maccabean Rebellion is a rebellion led by these five brothers, the sons of Mattathiah Hashmonai, Mattathias, who was a displaced priest. In other words, there are several priestly families in Israel. One of them had been the family of the priest in Jerusalem until Antiochus IV came in. And that family, of course, exiled itself to Egypt under Onias III. Then another priestly family came in. The Hasmoneans were another priestly family that was dispossessed from the temple. They were not in the temple. They lived in the city of Modin, south of Jerusalem. And they started the rebellion against the paganism which was taking place in Jerusalem. And the leader of the rebellion was Judah Maccabee. So we call it the Maccabean Rebellion. Judah Maccabee started a war against the emperor Antiochus IV. And this has happened in history before. Antiochus IV had the largest army, the biggest military force. The Maccabees fought a little guerrilla warfare on a small scale. but they were constantly inflicting pain and suffering on the armies of Antiochus. So it's a classic example of a guerrilla force fighting against a big power, and, as we'll see eventually, emerging victorious. By the way, it's interesting, the rebellion of Judah Maccabees started against the priests in Jerusalem. It didn't start against Antiochus. It starts out as their rebellion saying, you have contaminated the temple in Jerusalem, we want it cleaned. The notion of fighting for independence never entered their minds. No. They just resented the fact that the temple had been contaminated by the pagan intrusions. So they were fighting against the priests in Jerusalem. When Judah Maccabee began to inflict pain on the pagan syncretists in Jerusalem, they called upon the emperor to defend them. That's when Antiochus sent in an army to defend the pagan priests in Jerusalem against Judah Maccabee. He sent in an army thinking, well, my armies are well organized. They follow the Alexandrian pattern of the Macedonian phalanx. I mean, we are the most advanced army. But, you know, Judah Maccabee doesn't meet them head on. He attacks them from secret, from behind. He attacks them from the sides. He comes out from the forests and from the caves. They were not able to get him, and he defeated an army of Antiochus. That's when Antiochus decides to send in another army. And Judah Maccabee, by the way, while he is conducting this, is also studying the Greek tactics. And he is following them, and he has his men spying and following the armies as they are moving through the country. At one particular encounter at a place called Emmaus, Judah Maccabee encounters a significant Greek force, and he has his men prepared on the sides, forests, and behind rocks and so on, and the force keeps coming, and he attacks at the critical moment, and he defeats this army. A Greek force of Antiochus comes in, and at the town of Emmaus, or near the town of Emmaus, Judah Maccabee annihilates them. And when he does, he has a clear road to Jerusalem. Nobody can stop him. So he goes on to Jerusalem, and he takes control of the city. First thing he does when he takes control of the city is to drive the pagans out of the temple, remove all of the statues and contamination, cleanse the place, and says to the people of Jerusalem, we're going to rededicate the temple. And he establishes this festival, which is called Hanukkah, which means dedication. And he says, we're going to celebrate this for 8 days, and they rededicate the temple. Now, that was the great victory. It's not the end of the war, by the way. It's just a victory, but a very important one. However, it's important for another reason. The Romans are aware of this, and so they send a delegation to Jerusalem, and they say to Judah Maccabee, we are your friends and allies, and we will defend you, and I think it's time for us to really get together, and we would like to have you send a delegation to Rome. So Judah Maccabee sends two ambassadors to Rome. They come to Rome, and the Roman Senate hails them as the great heroes of Judean independence. Judah Maccabee never thought of independence. But this is what the Romans are saying, that you are now in the position where you can cut yourself off from the empire of Antiochus. You know what the Romans wanted. They wanted to weaken Antiochus as much as they could, whatever they could do. Here was an opportunity for the Romans. The next thing you know, the Romans draw up a mutual defense treaty between the Jews and the Romans. That treaty, by the way, is recorded in the Book of Maccabees, chapter 8. It's a full-fledged mutual defense treaty between the Romans and the Jews. And the Jews established an embassy in Rome. It's 161 BC. That's the beginning of the Jewish community of Rome, 161 BC. And the Jewish community of Rome has continued unbroken down to the present day. Now, Judah Maccabee now has a mutual defense pact with the Romans. But it's interesting the way it says, if Rome is attacked, the Jews will come to the defense of Rome. If Judah is attacked, the Romans will come to the defense of the Jews. They didn't because They didn't have to. Judah Maccabee continued to win small victories and to remain on top of the situation. But what they did do is the Romans sent a letter to the emperor, who was no longer Antiochus IV. He had died. He was succeeded by Demetrius. And the Romans sent a letter to Demetrius saying, "We are friendly with the Jews, and you have committed aggression against them, and we warn you. If you should commit aggression against the Jews, we will come to their aid according to our mutual defense pact, which we have with them." That letter is interesting because it's a warning. The Romans never did have to do that because the Jews managed to maintain themselves. And not only that, because of the Maccabean rebellion, the Seleucid Empire begins to crack. And it begins to crack because others in the Seleucid Empire realize that Antiochus has lost his battles. He lost the invasion of Egypt. His armies were defeated by Judah Maccabee. And so rivals begin to arise, and then there is a civil war breaking out in the Seleucid Empire. In the meantime, the war goes on. By the way, when we speak of the Maccabean Rebellion, if you've ever heard that what we call a thumbnail sketch of the Maccabean Rebellion, the Jews fought for their freedom. They fought to cleanse the temple. They cleansed the temple. They lit the candles. Instead of a bottle for one day, it burned for 8 days. That was the miracle. They celebrated Hanukkah, and that's the end of the story. That's not the story. No, when you read the history, that's not what happened. The war of the Maccabees against the Seleucid Empire went on for 20 years. It was a bloody, horrible war. Now, the war lasted for a long time. And in the course of the war, of the five brothers, Judah Maccabee and his five brothers, four were killed. Judah Maccabee also. The one who remained was Simon. Simon was now the leader of the rebellion. But in the meantime, there was a civil war going on in Syria, in the Seleucid Empire, and one of the participants appealed to the Maccabee brothers, to Simon, for help, in effect recognizing Israel as an independent state. So in effect, you could say that the independent state of Israel, which we call the Second Jewish Commonwealth of the Hasmonean Dynasty, becomes an independent Jewish state in about 155 BC. About 155 BC, an independent Jewish state emerges in the land of Israel.
That was Dr. David Nyman on the historical background to the Hanukkah story. The full version of this lecture is part of an audiobook called The Jews in History, available at drdavidnyman.com and audible.com. Thank you for listening to Context, the podcast. You can follow the Context blog on the Times of Israel website. And please visit drdavidnyman.com for more audio, video, and other fascinating information.